and 107.5 FM W298DK Amory, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. Danger in today's weather forecast for parts of the Midwest. Tornado watch is issued for parts of Iowa, Kansas, Missouri, Oklahoma, and Texas. Powerful storms move through Nebraska on Friday. ABC's Melissa Adons in one Omaha suburb.
Elkhorn flattened, homes shredded, roofs ripped off homes.
I was crying like a baby because it was just the scariest feeling in the world. Yet it was helpless.
Residents now picking up the pieces of what's left, and search and rescue efforts still underway. At least two people injured in the town, according to local officials.
Two deputies in Polk County, Florida, were shot and injured last night in Lakeland. The suspect was killed in the shootout. The NTSB is sending investigators to the scene of a freight train derailment in New Mexico, where at least two cars carrying propane caught fire and exploded. No injuries reported, but there have been evacuations. This is ABC News. Nearly a year after six people were killed in a school shooting in Nashville, Tennessee's governor signed legislation into law that allows teachers and staff to carry concealed handguns on the grounds of public schools. And the final sentence handed down on the 2019 death of Elijah McClain, the black man stopped by police, held down and injected with a drug by responding paramedics. He died Friday. The last paramedic involved was sentenced.
What I would like to do now is just talk to Elijah.
Aurora, Colorado Fire Department paramedic Jeremy Cooper stood at his sentencing and spoke to 23-year-old Elijah McClain, who died in his care after Cooper injected him with ketamine to calm him in police custody.
Elijah, I am a man of faith. I know you are here among us, and you can hear me.
McClain's heart stopped, and he later died.
I want you to know how sorry I am that I couldn't save you.
Convicted of criminally negligent homicide, Cooper was given 4 years probation.
That's ABC's Alex Stone. I'm Brian Clark, ABC News.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
This past week, the far, far right created what they called the Floor Action Response Team. The acronym there is FART. And no such stealth bills came to the floor that would cause the fart to rise. Again, I fact-checked it. That's what they called themselves.
That name really stinks, Maggie. Sorry,
let
I had
the
to.
Puns roll
the
in.
Maggie Dawn Show, weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. The Todd Alba Show.
State Senator Kelda Royce in Richland County. UW System made the unilateral decision to completely vacate the campus by July 1st of this year.
It's so short-sighted to think it costs a little bit more money to run it and there aren't as many students, so let's just shut it down. A smart business owner would say now is the time to invest because we know every person that comes through the door, you're going to get 40-fold the investment from how they're going to be able to give back to our state.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Consumer advocates are warning people about the hidden costs of taking out small loans on smartphone apps. Here's Mike Moe.
The Center for Responsible Lending is out with findings that detail how earned wage advances from digital platforms come with extra costs disguised as things like tips. Traditional payday lenders are often criticized for charging excessive interest rates on loans that are usually around $500. The center's Lucia Constantine says customers are usually seeking smaller amounts from the apps, but she warns they can be just as costly.
They are trapping consumers in a cycle of borrowing that is similar to that of a payday loan.
The report says after using these financial products, customers are seeing overdrafts on their checking accounts increase by 56% on average. Industry leaders deny they're barraging customers with hidden fees, stressing that features like suggested tips are optional. More broadly, a bipartisan payday loan reform bill in the Wisconsin legislature failed to advance this month. Constantine says, like longstanding payday lenders, these cash advance apps can be hard to regulate. Meanwhile, she urges those in a bind to explore other options.
Try talking to their friends and family as a first source. The other option, which I would recommend, is reaching out to their credit union or banking institution to see if they can get some sort of small dollar loan.
She says places like credit unions typically provide more transparency on loan costs. According to the report, 3/4 of consumers took out at least one advance on the same day or day after a repayment was posted. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, scattered showers and storms, otherwise mostly cloudy and breezy, with a high around 67. Rain tonight with a low of 48, showers and 58 on your Sunday. For Monday, scattered showers and thunderstorms, mostly cloudy and breezy, with a high around 59.
Currently, 56 degrees.
Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, the Madison Mallards' Kyle Chisholm joins us to talk all things baseball. Three headlines in a lie. I hope you can join us.
Matt Nair on air, weekday mornings at 10.
You're listening to Lake Air, WLAK, Amory's home for Up North News Radio.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. I am your host for this, our second hour on our weekend broadcast, doing a very careful and deep analysis of what happened in our nation's highest court this past Thursday, oral argument in Trump versus United States, in which the Supreme Court stunningly, shockingly, revoltingly began to entertain the notion that there is indeed a package of pieces of conduct, behaviors in which our chief executive can partake, can do, that would not be subject to prosecution if there are crimes. And the majority, it appears, of the Supreme Court articulating this difference between personal notions, personal behaviors, and official notions, official behaviors, as a way of describing that in some fashion. Along the way, we had appropriate pushback from Ketanji Brown Jackson, raising the specter about the possibility of turning the Oval Office once again into the seat of criminality if, in fact, you give a president complete immunity or something short of the affirmance that you can, in fact, be prosecuted for crimes that you committed. Along the way, Sonia Sotomayor also asks about the limits and the extent to which these immunities would attach. She says, what if the president were to order the military to stage a coup? He is the commander-in-chief and orders the military to stage a coup to keep himself, herself in office, plainly for a personal benefit. She also asks, what if the chief executive orders the assassination of a rival? Is that the kind of thing that could be accomplished with impunity? And stunningly, once again, John Sauer, counsel for Donald Trump, says it depends on the circumstances. No, it does not. No, it does not. And Sonia Sotomayor and Tanji Brown Jackson, and yes, Elena Kagan, underscoring this fundamental notion. Elena Kagan, a spectacular job in saying this. The framers understood. They knew how to do immunities. They knew how to accomplish immunities in state court constitutions. They didn't do it here. There is nothing in this Constitution, just the opposite. Nothing in this Constitution that says that there is an immunity of any kind, of any dimension. They didn't do it. They knew how to do it. They expressly did not do it. And goes on to affirm once again, the president is not above the law. Again, implicit and explicit in every single page of our Constitution. And she says, wasn't that the point? Wasn't that the entire point of rejecting the king in England? Wasn't that the point? And she then invokes, as do her other colleagues, Sonia Sotomayor and Ketanji Brown Jackson, this all-important language in Article 2, nestled near the end of Section 2 of Article 2, that says that the president shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed. the laws be faithfully executed. That's the take care clause that we have often talked about on this broadcast, underscoring the significance of what that means. If the President of the United States of America is obliged to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, and yet he or she, himself or herself, as to his or her own conduct, can engage in violations of those very laws that he is or she is obliged to take care that they be enforced and executed, does not that stand the Constitution on its head? And as I have offered, begin to crumble the very foundations of our tripartite branch of government, where we've got executive branch, we've got a legislative branch, a judicial branch. If we have an executive not subject to the rule of law in America, we are beginning not only to undermine the language of the Constitution, but to bring to a close this 240-year experiment in democracy, a republic in our nation that is threatened now by this argument and the embracing of a partial, if not complete, but a partial immunity for crimes committed by an executive in office. That is what brings us to our callers, calling in at 855-752-4842. You can call in. You can also text us. And you can also use the Civic Media app to engage in this, our conversations, our questions about what's going on with the Supreme Court. We're going to begin with Joe. Joe, glad to have you with me once again this weekend on our broadcast. And Joe, do we have...
Yes. Thank you. I appreciate this. It's really a detailed, and I appreciate the passion with which you're speaking when you use words such as "it's a horrifying situation." It gives us a sense of the catastrophe that's ahead if the president is not subject to the laws of the nation. I mean, of course it's going to become a crime center. I mean, if I were a criminal, I would say, geez, good time, good pickings. Get myself elected president by any means necessary and watch out. A question I would ask for you is that at present we're talking about the chief executive. What's to say if the Supreme Court says, okay, there's a the president, the executive does have immunity for acts that we may consider criminal, such as murder or a coup or bribery. What's to prevent that from filtering on down to the executives at the governor's levels? I mean, there's a lot of contracts or appointments that are made. One could say, in the same way that they were looking at ambassadorships and saying, well, if you took a bribe to get someone who wanted to be an ambassador, would that be a personal or would that be an official act? It seems to me that it's opening up a can of worms that is never going to be closed if you have this partial immunity, because people are going to try to parse out how can I do it? What can I attach to my act to make it be official? And thus I would be free from any consequence. So I'd be interested in your reaction to those two points. What if it goes down to the executives at the gubernatorial level? And what if you then have people who are just seeking any little loophole, any back door, any off ramp to get them out of a charge by attaching official duties to it? So I'd be curious what your reaction is. Thanks, Jim.
Joe, as always, very important questions. And along with Michael Dreeben, I'd offer, Joe, that you and others, other listeners, should be right there raising those kinds of specters, ghosts, the possibility of terrible things happening. Yes, indeed, the courts can appropriately be thinking about the next case. And along the way, before I get to the specifics in response to your very good questions, Joe, I would offer this, that this is not a Supreme Court that wanted to listen to the specifics of this case. They wanted to entertain the future, the possibilities of the implications of their orders. And again, appellate courts often do that. They think about the next case, the next issue, Mr. Santel, that we need to wrestle with, and how should we craft a standard that will address not just this case, but down the road. That process in and of itself about what happens, the consequences, is not inappropriate for an appellate court. The difficulty, of course, here, as you listen to this oral argument, is the majority wanted to hear nothing about these particular facts, the particular allegations against Donald Trump, notwithstanding Michael Dreeben's consistent attempt to do so, but wanted to pose all sorts of hypotheticals, including of the sort that you raise. Let's talk about these loophole options. Michael Dreeben and others, even in the wake of this oral argument, asking about how do you define, and this goes to the core of your points and your questions, Joe, How do you define this distinction? I think one of the people in America who should be most concerned about what happened on Thursday is, in fact, Tanya Chutkan. She is a district court judge who presumably is going to be on the receiving end of some sort of order coming up in June, telling her with some standards, perhaps, maybe, or maybe not, that she needs to parse through this and figure out which among the charges, the pieces of evidence presented during the course of the trial, which of those are official, which of those, in fact, could be identified, perhaps, as a loophole, Joe, as you identified it as well, and could be falling in one bucket as opposed to another, a bucket of personal behavior as opposed to official behavior. The process is virtually impossible to do, even inside of a system of jurisprudence that contemplates standards all the time. And we do establish standards. I wonder out loud, as does your second question, about the possibility of identifying what's on the left side of the line, what's on the right side of the line, that prospect that you've got future presidents trying as best they can to stay on the appropriate side, and I say appropriate in quotes, only because if it is criminal activity, it should be subject to prosecution. But trying to find those loopholes out there, depending upon a standard that cannot be properly understood and cannot be properly articulated, Tanya Chutkan must be very concerned today about the job that they may be, that she may be getting from the Supreme Court in trying to address those kinds of things. The first point you make, Joe, about the collateral consequences of this, if indeed there is immunity in a president, for whom else, right? We do always think about the next case. Does the next case involve a governor? Does an estate proceeding, admittedly a state matter, not a federal matter, and there's a distinction there, and there could be that argument made about the applicability of state versus federal matters, but could someone on behalf of a governor say the United States Supreme Court, the Supreme Court of the land, has described the authority of a chief executive, much like a governor, much like cabinet officials, whether federal or state, much like any other agency folks out there who might have impunity when it comes to the kinds of things that the Supreme Court is talking about. That's the concern, too. Even if you articulate in some wildly imperfect way, wildly unclear way, what is the consequence down the road beyond just the presidency today, this week, and in the next 6 weeks, and perhaps beyond that? We focus especially upon the consequences of this for our republic and the consequences for the presidency, for which we're selecting a new incumbent come November, or a next incumbent come November. Very important points, very important observations to make, Joe, about the consequences of all of this. We also have on the phone Jean from Eau Claire. Jean, glad to have you calling in our weekend broadcast. And I think we've got Jean. Yes, Jean, go ahead.
Oh, thank you. Okay, thank you so much. Thank you for taking my call. I was mortified when I watched live. I took a lot of notes, and there were a lot of themes that kept going through their questions. And, you know, presidents on duty like 24/7, the crimes were committed against us. What about crimes of treason when a president is on duty? Can he commit treason? Also ordering the military to attack others within our country. I mean, he can make up his own laws as long as they're in his official capacity. I think that this is ludicrous. And also, this is a president that put those people on the stand when they didn't always tell the truth. And I watched them when they were questioned by the Senate, and they said other things than what, you know, what was true. So I hope there's ideas of what we can do as a nation to fight back on this. Thank you so much for all the things you're doing, because a president's on duty 24/7. And if he does commit a crime, he could say, it's been my official duty.
You're listening to Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK.
Hey, Wisconsin, it's construction season, and the Wisconsin DOT wants to help you safely navigate work zones in your area. Check 511WI.gov or download the free 511 app to see current road work, closures, detours, and camera views on your route. Wherever your travels take you, know before you go with 511WI.gov. That's 511WI.gov. And remember, know before you go. Always park the phone while driving. Sponsored by the Wisconsin DOT.
The possibility of lung cancer can be pretty scary, especially if you're one of approximately 8 million current or former smokers at high risk. That's why SaveByTheScan.org wants you to know that now there's a breakthrough low-dose CT scan that can detect lung cancer early, and it only takes 60 seconds. You stop smoking, now start screening. For an easy quiz to see if you're eligible, visit SaveByTheScan.org. It could save your life. SaveByTheScan.org is brought to you by the American Lung Association's Lung Force Initiative and the Ad Council.
You're listening to Lake Air, WLAK, Amory's home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, and yes, I am your host on this, our weekend review of issues related to law and government and justice in America, focusing especially, almost exclusively, on this weekend broadcast on this stunning oral argument in front of the Supreme Court just this past Thursday. Along the way, the Chief Justice, including references to the lower court opinions and his dissatisfaction with them, in his overall comments about the problems with the government's position. He said the appellate court, that is the D.C. court, did not get into a focused consideration of what acts we are talking about or what documents we are talking about, and suggested along the way, as did other members of the Supreme Court, that what has to happen here is we need further proceedings, which also gives life to those who argue that what this is really all about is extending the time so that this trial cannot happen at any time in this calendar year, almost now certainly prohibitive in terms of the calendar. But further proceedings back in front of Tanya Chutkan, presumably to flesh out some of these documents and the acts we're talking about, and presumably, once again, to put into action for the first time in our nation's history some distinction between official acts of a president and personal acts of the president, even though they are, as Michael Dreeben often said during the course of this oral argument, completely integrated as a part of a conspiracy to overturn the election results. The Chief Justice saying further proceedings are needed, and for that reason, also almost certainly sending this case back down to the district court for whatever those further proceedings might be. Along the way, we also know that Justice Gorsuch similarly raising concerns about things that he sees as specters out there. He describes the concern about a president who could self-pardon. It seems to me, he says, like one of the incentives that might be created is for presidents to try to pardon themselves if indeed there is the prospect of criminal prosecution. Once again, that's never happened in our history. And the Chief Justice, like Sam Alito, engaging there in a very cynical view about what government does and should do. An awful lot of people on both sides of the political aisle, when it comes to pardons, as we have discussed on this broadcast in the past, recognize that the pardon authority is not a reflexive authority. That is, president cannot pardon himself, recognizing again in the same breath that there is no check on that, that perhaps Donald Trump, if he becomes the next president, could indeed do just that. But that authority, and implicitly, if not explicitly, saying that that authority exists to pardon yourself inside an official argument before the Supreme Court also sends the wrong messages about civics, about government, about how our government works to all Americans. And beyond that, underscores this fundamental notion that pardons should be the product of a deliberative process inside the Department of Justice, which is where Michael Dreeben comes from. There is an Office of the Pardon Attorney that makes recommendations to the president about those pardons that should be granted, clemency that should be granted, those petitions that should not. All of that, likewise, a disingenuous argument. Along the way, as wrestling with this attempt to identify a rule or a set of standards, get back to Justice Alito. He says, I'm proposing a broad principle to distinguish between official and unofficial conduct. Suppose, he says, the rule were that a former president cannot be prosecuted for official acts unless no plausible justification could be imagined for what the president did, taking into account history and legal precedent. Wow. Justice Sotomayor jumps all over that, saying that plausible is little different from absolute. What is plausible about the president insisting and creating a fraudulent slate of electoral candidates, she asked. Indeed, underscoring this impossibility, Justice Alito, Justice Gorsuch, Justice Coney Barrett, Justice Chief Justice Roberts, and others of articulating a standard here that makes some real sense. And so the question comes, what do we do about all this? In the last segment, Gene called in and asked, what kinds of things should we do in response to this? Well, a couple of things we're going to offer about what may happen down the road in June and the opportunities that we have citizens become involved in this very process as our discussion here on Amicus, a Law Review, continues on this, our weekend show.
Lake Air, 1260 AM WLAK.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. Danger in today's weather forecast for parts of the Midwest. Tornado watch is issued for parts of Iowa, Kansas, Missouri, Oklahoma, and Texas. Powerful storms move through Nebraska on Friday. ABC's Melissa Adons in one Omaha suburb.
Elkhorn flattened, homes shredded, roofs ripped off homes.
I was crying like a baby because it was just the scariest feeling in the world, yet it was helpless.
Residents now picking up the pieces of what's left, and search and rescue efforts still underway. At least two people injured in the town, according to local officials.
Two deputies in Polk County, Florida, were shot and injured last night in Lakeland. The suspect was killed in the shootout. The NTSB is sending investigators to the scene of a freight train derailment in New Mexico, where at least two cars carrying propane caught fire and exploded. No injuries reported, but there have been evacuations. This is ABC News.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
The Bucks lose in overtime. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Bucks able to send the game into OT thanks to Chris Middleton, but Milwaukee losing Game 3 in Indy. 121-118. The Pacers lead the series 2-1. Doc Rivers.
This game came down to 50-50, and they just did a better job of, you know, our guys were fighting, couldn't get to loose balls. You know, when you shoot better than the other team, but they take, 17 more shots than you, you're not going to win that game.
Baseball, the Brewers with a win. They went into extra innings. 7-6 over the Yankees. Milwaukee's Joey Ortiz with a home run and 4 RBI, driving in the winning run in the bottom of the 11th. NFL, the Packers have drafted 5 players, 2 on offense, 3 on defense, with 8 picks left to go.
We were able to kind of stay with the best player available. There were some guys we had rated, you know, equally, and then Need maybe played a little bit of part in that as well, but we never had to dip down around or anything like that.
That's Packers GM Brian Gutekunst. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, scattered showers and storms, otherwise mostly cloudy and breezy, with a high around 67. Rain tonight with a low of 48, showers and 58 on your Sunday. For Monday, scattered showers and thunderstorms, mostly cloudy and breezy, with a high around 59.
It's 54 right now.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Are you and your family weather ready?
I'm Terry Barr, producer of the Slice of Wisconsin series. Wisconsin weather is ever-changing, and all of us with Civic Media believe awareness can make a difference. Our weather-ready stories will offer the information you need. Here's meteorologist Brittany Merlot.
A weather radio should be considered an important piece of your family's safety plan. It's an automated 24-hour emergency source, which is a reliable way to receive weather alerts and information about a storm, tornado, or flood in your area. And if you lose power, these radios have a battery backup. NOAA Weather Radio All Hazards Awareness Day is Wednesday, May 1st. As a Weather Ready ambassador, I suggest taking time to learn how these radios work, whether you are inside or out on your boat or camping. The Wisconsin Emergency Management website is a great place to start. Go to wem.wi.gov. I'm meteorologist Brittany Merlot.
Busted Pencils with Dr. Tim and Dr. Johnny.
I wonder what Matt Damon's mom would say when it comes to teaching science to little kids.
Wait, what? You want to know what my mom would say? All right, well, just ask her.
And there she is, Dr. Nancy Carlson Page. Welcome to Busted Pencils. Nancy, how are you?
Hey, I'm great. It's great to see you. It's great to be here.
Busted Pencils, fully leaded education talk. Weeknights at 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Todd Albaugh.
Hey, everybody, join us next time as we recap the weekend news events and kick off It's Gonna Be May Week.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2.
It's gonna be May.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, and we are talking all about this oral argument before the United States Supreme Court in Trump versus United States of America. Jean called in a while back and said, well, what do we do about this? What kinds of things can happen? Let's take that issue up right now. Now, we know from the past that oral arguments are pretty good predictors. Not always, but usually reading the tea leaves got a pretty good sense of what's going to happen. We knew, for example, on December 1 of 2021, the day that the oral argument was conducted in the Dobbs case, 6 months before the Supreme Court actually decided the case on June 24th, almost 7 months, June 24th, 2022, when Sam Alito wrote for the majority in that case, that a privacy right to reproductive rights, to abortion, no longer is inside the Constitution, was never there, he says. Wrongly decided Roe versus Wade in 1973. We knew from the oral argument way back in December of the previous year that it was highly likely the Supreme Court was just about to overturn Roe versus Wade. We are in a much compressed time period right now. And yet, sometime in the next 6 weeks, there are opportunities. There are opportunities both inside the court and outside the court. It is possible. And this is why I am hopeful. I am hopeful still. A small portion of me intellectually embraces the notion that members of this Supreme Court, after hearing these things out loud, or at least maybe more than just the three, maybe more than just Sonia Sotomayor and Ketanji Brown Jackson and Elena Kagan, maybe a John Roberts, maybe an Amy Coney Barrett, which gets us up to five, maybe they go back and they say, you know what? Some of this is a bridge too far. It's plain from the tea leaves reading from this oral argument that the others may be all in on this notion of sort of a bifurcated personal and official capacity analysis. But maybe they sit down, especially if they view this oral argument as a test run, if you will, for a theory that is ridiculous. For a trial balloon sometimes happens, not so much in judicial circles, but in other circumstances of government. Let's see how this plays before we embrace the entire concept. Let's do comments on a proposed rule. That's a part of our routine process under something called the Administrative Procedures Act. Let's see how this would play out. Is there a possibility that the Supreme Court was entertaining these ridiculous notions on Thursday just to see how they would fly? And in the wake of that, as soon as Thursday and afternoon and Friday and this weekend and in the weeks ahead, if the response by the American public is as animated as it should be, and the Supreme Court hears, and they do in fact live in the real world, not just from editorialists in the major publications of our nation, but from people across the country on radio broadcasts like this and others, that this is not a tolerable road to pursue. That if indeed the Supreme Court is going to identify any bucket of criminal activity in which the chief executive can engage with impunity, we are indeed beginning to revoke, if not revoking, rescinding completely the fundamental structures of a republic and of our Constitution. Maybe they sit down among themselves and say, we are hearing from enough people, and enough people on both sides of the political aisle. Everybody should be equally concerned about what we heard on Thursday. If, in fact, that message is heard by them, whether they internalize that or not, in external conversation among them, and say, you know what? That was interesting. Maybe we do go back and need to write the two-paragraph order that the Court of Appeals expanded into many, many pages, and the District Court expanded in many, many pages. It basically says this is ridiculous. And we entertained this oral argument, but not for the idea of seriously entertaining it, but just to explore all sorts of avenues here. I hold out little hope that that will happen, that self-analysis, that self-examination inside the Supreme Court will happen. But that's what's going on right now. After this oral argument now, they are sending around drafts of an opinion, a majority opinion. Plainly, there will be scathing dissents, if indeed this happens as we think it may happen, from the majority. opinion, scathing dissents opposing what the majority opinion is saying. Those dissents will be scathing in their content and in their tone. And maybe just as that process goes ahead and these drafts are exchanged internally, a process that we do not see, maybe during the course of that process, a John Roberts, maybe an Amy Coney Barrett comes to their senses and says, no, let us reaffirm the fundamental notions upon which our government has been predicated. As to these other matters involving Donald Trump, we've already told him in the Colorado case, he is on the ballot. We will likely tell him in that Fisher case we talked about before that the underlying statute that underlies two of those four counts may be subject to attack. Go ahead and give Donald Trump, if you're going to do that, the victories, if you will, in that case. And let Tanya Chutkan wrestle with the consequences of an unfavorable decision in Fisher. But don't do this. Don't do this. This is a bridge too far. And so how do we go about affecting, to Gene's invocation and question, how do we go about doing this? Well, we know that the process of impeachment is almost certainly not an option. It cannot happen under this present political situation. Resignation is not going to happen as well. So those kinds of things. We know that this president, early on in his term, commissioned a group to look at the Supreme Court, and they came up with some non-decisive results of their examination, but including options for, yes, indeed, increasing the numbers of Supreme Court justices. Perhaps even there's legislation by Sheldon Whitehouse in the United States Senate and others to limit the terms of senators. And that may seem contrary to the content and the words of the Good Behavior Clause of the Constitution, but that too should be pursued, perhaps not as quickly as one would like in the next 6 weeks, but as long-term attempt to address this kind of behavior, if indeed the Supreme Court is going down this road. More significantly, what can we do? Education and advocacy. How about letters? How about writing letters to the Chief Justice, to Amy Coney Barrett, to other members of the Supreme Court? Send them a letter and tell them that you're concerned about the future of our nation. Tell them that we're concerned about undermining the future of a republic by establishing an imperial presidency and going back to King George, which we have not done in 240 years. Talk with them, if you will, about their own traditions in recent times of limiting the powers of the presidency when it comes to things like reducing and eliminating student loan in the education department, finding that's a bridge too far. The president cannot do that. Finding that the president cannot limit the exposure to employees in large companies to COVID. President can't do that. They invoke something called the major questions doctrine, saying that goes too far. The president does not have those capacities to do that. They have limited the Voting Rights Act in two major cases called Shelby County and Brnovich, the second of which authored by Sam Alito, finding for the first time in our nation's history that fraud may be a reason to impose limitations and restrictions on voting in America, an incredible notion written into the opinion in Brnovich. They have limited in recent years the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, again, as inappropriate exercises of executive authority. Invoke those and tell members of the Supreme Court that if they are consistent with those views about a limited presidency, you cannot both do that and at the same time vest in the same person who does not have these other powers to, yes, indeed, take care that the laws of our nation be properly executed and properly informed in terms of the execution by the agencies. If you cannot do all of those things, you certainly cannot, in the next breath, grant that person any form of immunity for criminal acts that might be involved in the execution of that work. Send them letters. And beyond that, send those letters to others in government. Support Sheldon Whitehouse. Support our own senator and maybe senators, our own congressmen and women who might be willing to acknowledge that this time the Supreme Court has gone too far. Send our elected representatives letters so that they too can be a part of the voice against this in the public. Write a letter to the editor of your own newspaper explaining the seriousness of this and explaining why it is that this is about the future of our nation and the Supreme Court appears to be getting it wrong. Do it now. Do it now in the next few weeks before in June we come back together on this broadcast and others and talk about the implications of an order that articulates in some imperfect way a standard for the assessment of what is public and what is official and what is private and what is personal, and on that basis make a determination about whether or not criminal conduct inside a presidency can be supported. All those things, the advocacy, the education, talk to young people, talk to middle-aged people, talk to older members of our good community who should be concerned about this, who vote again in August here in Wisconsin, and certainly in November here in Wisconsin and around the country. Talk with them about the importance of voting and the importance of that voting being predicated upon a government that does, in fact, have checks and balances, where no one is above the law, that everyone is subject to the laws, and that there is not such a thing as an imperial presidency or a king who happens to live in the White House. We have Mark on the phone. Mark, appreciate your waiting. Appreciate your call this morning, your comment or your question about our examination of this Supreme Court argument.
Yeah, I guess it's no longer shocking to me that we hear some of these people on the Supreme Court, you know, that not adhering to the fact that the president is subject to the law, to even entertaining that be entertained that the president is above the law, because it's clearly, you know, Hamilton clearly lays out in some of the Federalist Papers in 69, he says the president shall be, you know, amenable to punishment and disgrace, which clearly indicates to me, at least, that the president is subject to the law. They go on to describe, you know, a man that might, you know, and he goes on to describe a man in I think 75, where a man of avaricious or self-aggrandizement, you know, might seek to use the office, you know, for his own personal benefit. I mean, that, and even monarchs in English history were actually subject to the law. An example I bring up is Henry II, when he had, you know, that just made the off-flip comment, well, somebody remove this priest, and his household knights went there and murdered Thomas Becket, and Henry II was punished for his words. I mean, Charles II ignored Parliament, and Charles I ignored Parliament and lost his head. James II, you know, got into a tussle with Parliament and lost the monarchy.
Right, all those things, Mark. Again, you make reference to the Federalist Papers, in addition to our own history from Great Britain, from England as well. Federalist Papers replete, as you are indicating, with these notions. It is implicit. We do not have to say that the president has immunity or does not have immunity, because it's understood in virtually every single page of those documents written by Alexander Hamilton and James Madison and John Jay at the start of our nation. That too is a resource for our United States Supreme Court. That too should also be a resource for the kind of advocacy that I'm advocating when it comes to writing letters, informing our public, and doing those other things in the times just ahead that push back on this ridiculous and unfounded notion that somehow an immunity of any kind inheres in the executive branch of the United States government. It is an incredible notion. And again, all of this to underscore the possibility that the Supreme Court may still come to its senses, if you will, and not do this. But if they do, what are the consequences of those? And how do we implement this strange new regimen in our constitutional democracy, our republic? How do we go about putting that in place most immediately for a trial before Judge Tanya Chutkan, that no longer will happen in this calendar year, will not happen before this election? And how do we do it down the road for all the other implications that Joe raised before? What are the consequences of this? Invoking the Supreme Court's own invitation to think about the next cases, the things that the Supreme Court did want to talk about. What are the next implications for this down the road? How does that play out? All of that for your continuing consideration and all of us here on Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to Lake Air, WLAK, Amory's home for Matt Nair on Air. It's a polka party, and for good reason. 30 years ago, legislation making the polka our state dance became official in Pulaski.
I think everybody in Pulaski showed up in Zielinski Hall or on the streets because it was a polka day celebration.
That's then-Governor Tommy Thompson who signed the legislation in April 1994. But do you know who got the barrel rolling on the idea in the first place? The Wisconsin Polka Boosters, a class of second graders, or the State Folk Museum? The answer coming up.
It's tradition, it's culture, it's food, it's beer, you know, heritage.
Heritage back to the 1840s when the polka became popular with Europeans and came to America with them. So who started the Make Polka Our State Dance movement? A class of Madison second graders, but the Boosters and Folk Museum supported those efforts. It's a cultural slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
This is Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK.
This is Amicus, a law review, and my name is Jim Santel. In this, our final segment of our two-hour weekend broadcast, thank you once again for joining me in this discussion, focusing almost exclusively upon this all-important, hugely significant Supreme Court argument of just this past Thursday. We know that in another court of the land, very much related to this oral argument about the power of a president and the things that he or she may do in the executive function, and also those things that someone who is a candidate for president might do in advance of the election. We know that Donald Trump, right now, continuing to be in trial in front of Judge Juan Merchan in that Manhattan trial, sometimes called the hush money case, the catch and kill case. In fact, it's violations of 34 different counts, alleged in an indictment, once again, a grand jury indictment, alleging a payoff to a woman named Stormy Daniels for being quiet, keeping quiet about an alleged affair. And in that connection, plainly in the wake of the initial presentation by the prosecution on this past Monday, and certainly in the wake of the testimony, principally of a fellow named David Pecker, the principal theme of this trial comes through loudly and clearly, that while there may be some salacious elements of this, and yes, indeed, it is not the case that we're here to try whether or not there was a sexual relationship between Donald Trump and Stormy Daniels. That is not the case. We're here to determine whether or not there was a violation of state law and that the motive for that, as the prosecution is articulating, was election interference, much as it is in the argument in front of the Supreme Court, maybe ultimately in trial before Judge Tanya Chutkan. Along the way, the prosecutors identifying that as a principal theme and articulating this notion that witnesses and documents will support that theme, and indeed that's exactly what happened. Some comments generally about David Pecker and his testimony that occupied most of the trial days, not exclusively. There were a couple of more witnesses at the very end of yesterday's proceeding. One of them was a woman named Rona Graff, who you may recall, Donald Trump's executive assistant. She sometimes appeared when NBC put Donald Trump on the airwaves for 14 years in The Apprentice. She sometimes appeared as his executive assistant in that broadcast. She testified that on at least a couple of occasions, she was making contacts with both Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal and included their contacts in the official databases of the Trump Organization. She's no longer on the payroll of the Trump Organization, but apparently her legal bills are still being paid. But even so, even though she didn't want to be there, confirmed this seemingly small but nonetheless important corroborating event that indeed there were connections between Donald Trump and the organization and Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal. We also heard yesterday the testimony of another individual. His name is Gary Farrell. He is beginning to establish the piece of this that focuses specifically on Stormy Daniels. He comes forward and begins to identify some of the records. This is the financial records. This is the stuff that sometimes sounds dry, but it's very significant because he begins to establish the foundation for this $130,000 home equity loan that Michael Cohen took out that forms the basis for the payment to Stormy Daniels. We'll hear more from Gary Farrell next week. And yes, we will probably hear more from Michael Cohen himself. Michael Cohen, when he appears, sandwiched in the middle of this trial, unlike David Pecker, will present some to some, maybe on the jury, as being a flawed witness, and indeed he is, with a prior felony conviction for lying, other things, and plainly with an animus against Donald Trump. Lots of baggage there. But nonetheless, Michael Cohen will provide additional information about the nature of this transaction with not only Stormy Daniels, but also the prior involvement with Karen McDougal and the so-called doorman. And that gets us to the principal testimony involving this fellow named David Pecker. I would offer to you that for all sorts of reasons, he was a credible witness. Maybe not a likable witness. Don't have to enjoy someone who talks about how the process of journalism in America today involves catching and killing stories that are unfavorable to your clients and advancing unsupported stories for those people for whom you are advocating. But what did David Pecker basically said? He said that this scheme put together by him and Michael Cohen, and yes, by Donald Trump, was designed in principal part to affect the campaign, to affect the campaign. And he is clear about that. He talks about the fact that in the wake of doing just that, paying off the doorman, paying off Karen McDougal to keep quiet about these stories, one of which was not even true, that in the wake of that, Donald Trump, in a meeting right before he takes the White House, says, I want to thank you for handling the McDougal situation, the doorman situation. Those stories could be very embarrassing, very damaging to the campaign. That's what David Pecker says that Donald Trump tells him about this engagement. And the reason why that is important, once again, it establishes motive, and it also responds to something else that was raised during the course of the opening statements by the defense. The defense comes forward and says, you know what, this is not about campaign violations. Oh, by the way, no violations of the law at all, of New York law regarding financial documents. But this may have also just been about keeping this information from your wife, from your spouse, from Melania. And in fact, David Pecker's testimony, in which he describes not only this conversation, but says nothing about Donald Trump being concerned about revelations to Melania, but talks exclusively about revelations to the American public, undermine that defense too. And along the way at the White House in 2017, according to David Pecker, Donald Trump asked him to join him for lunch or dinner. And along the way, Donald Trump asks, how is Karen doing? And once again, expressing interest in the well-being of Karen McDougal. Previously, Donald Trump having said, how's our girl? Using some sexist language there. Donald Pecker responds, she's cool. She's very quiet. No issues. Donald Trump, from the testimony of David Pecker, compelling testimony about the focus of this transaction being not upon keeping your wife in the dark about it, but upon keeping the American population in the dark about this very important issue. Pecker also, of course, coming forward and saying, this is just business. This is a transaction. I like Donald Trump. He's my friend. I still like him. And what does that do? All of these things tend to suggest that David Pecker is a credible witness. You don't have to like him in the literal sense of the word, but he is someone who's providing information that is corroborated, will be further corroborated by Michael Cohen, by these documents that are coming in, by other people, but a very strong witness at the start of what appears to be a very compelling criminal case in the Manhattan trial court in front of Judge Mershon. We'll talk more about that, of course, in future broadcasts. And that brings to the end this broadcast of Amica.
You're listening to Lake Air, WLAK, Amory's home for Up North News Radio.
Pat Kreitlow.
Monday morning, we'll talk live with former and maybe future Congressman Peter Barca about his decision to run this fall in Southeast Wisconsin's 1st District.
Up North News with Pat Kreitlow, weekday mornings starting at 6. What does cheese, beer, and you have to do with local radio?
I know. It's Todd Alba and the Trick V. Olsen's What Makes Wisconsin Great Tour.
To get out of your own little silo and just listen to folks, you find out Wisconsin is pretty darn great already.
It's great to be from Wisconsin, Todd. It's just such a fantastic place.
Miss them in your town, more visits, and your chance to connect coming up.
The Todd Alba Show, weekdays noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and the app. Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app. You're listening to Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK Amory and 107.5 FM W298 DK Amory, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.